Tonight we want to continue our study together of the survey of the entire Bible. We began this some months ago. We are alternating between the Old and New Testament, and from time to time on Sunday evenings we are taking a book and we are giving the overview of the book and some lessons that we can learn from the books to help us to have a better understanding of the whole Bible, and especially some of the books that we don't look at very much and we don't spend a lot of time in. Therefore, we don't have very good understanding of the powerful lessons that are contained therein. I'm amazed at the ignorance of people who claim to be religious concerning much of Old Testament history. A number of months ago on a program that I'm sure that you all have heard of, Jeopardy. In Final Jeopardy, they had a question concerning Bible history. And the question is about the lady that we're going to talk about tonight. And they asked who was the queen that took the place of Queen Vashti in the realm of the Persian Empire. That's contained, the story is contained in the Bible. And there were two people that when they're doing their introductions, telling them who they are, there was one of them who was a lay minister. And I thought that was interesting, so I knew when that question came up in Double Jeopardy, sure, of course, he'd get it right. He didn't know, and I thought that tells me a lot about how much time he spends in the Bible. And so I want you to take your Old Testaments on to the book of Esther. Esther is probably one of the most beloved women in Old Testament history. She's a very courageous woman. And what we remember most about her is a passage in that book in chapter 4 and verse 14. In chapter 4 and verse 14, the text tells us, "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arrive from the Jews from another place. But you and your father's household will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this." And the key to that statement, have you been put in this position, in this time, at this place, to be able to do something for God that nobody else could do except you? And when you study the book of Esther, it's very interesting to know that that's indeed exactly what happened. And we'll talk about that more at the end of the lesson when we talk about the lessons from the book of Esther. But let's talk a little bit about the book. The book is set in the background of the third year of the reign of Ahasuerus of Persia. He's the king, and it's in the third year of his realm. He has a six-month banquet. What do you think about that? 180 days of banqueting in order to just celebrate his kingdom and his prosperity. And following that six-month banquet for 180 days, he has a seven-day banquet for all who live in the capital city of Shushan. And so this banquet and this feast continues for another 7 days. Now, during this seven-day feast, after the 6 months of feasting, they had much drinking, the Bible tells us, and the king commanded Queen Vashti, who is his wife, who was in another part of the kingdom, entertaining the wives of the nobles that he was entertaining in his feast, and he commands that Queen Vashti come and parade her beauty before all these men at the feast that he is giving in the citadel. Now, we don't know exactly what that meant. There's been a lot of things by commentators and by people who make comment about the culture of that day that this could have meant many things. But one thing we do know, he was not in a very good state of mind because of the drinking that had been taking place. And Queen Vashti, even though being his wife and being the queen, she refused to come. She would not hearken to his request. And she did not obey the king's command. And because of her unwillingness to obey the king's command, that put some things in motion that really put the rest of the Bible story in motion. And so the king became enraged. And he became so enraged that he sought counsel from those wise people around him of what he should do about this and the ramifications to his kingdom when the word leaked out that his wife disobeyed him and refused the command when he commanded her to come in his presence. And so they said to the king that the queen must be set as an example. And their Vashti should be removed. Because what she has done is so terrible, and the example is so terrible, that what she needs to do is be removed from her place, and one that is better than her must be chosen. And the wise men kind of said, well, listen, the husband's wives in the kingdom are going to hear about what she did. And then they're going to follow suit, and they're not going to obey and respect their husbands, and then there's going to be a problem. And so you've got to make an example out of Vashti. And remember, he's enraged, he's angry, and he's asking for counsel, and instead of waiting for his rage to subside, he agrees with their counsel. And he decides to remove her from the position of queen, and as his wife, and to replace her with another woman. Now, beautiful virgins who happen to be in his province, and there are 120 different cities in his province, all the virgins are brought to the king's harem so he could choose a queen. The Bible text tells us there's about 400 of them, and they're chosen from all of his provinces, all the things that he has jurisdiction over, and they're brought into a harem for him to decide who will be the next queen. Now, in that harem, they don't just come before the queen or the king and parade before him. There's a beautification process. And this is a very elaborate process of 6 months of beautifying with oils and 6 months of beautifying the skins with perfume. And each woman must go through this ritual. And so each one of these women is going through a year-long purification before she will ever come in presence of the king. Now, then she'll be called to spend one night with the king. Her name will come up, and she'll be able to go to the king. She'll be able to take anything she wishes to take with her. And if he finds favor with her and calls her again, then she will be the one that will be queen. Now, all that sounds good, but if she is not chosen, she can never be another man's husband. Because then she is put in a separate harem, and she is really in widowhood, although she's never been married, and she's taken care of by the king's eunuchs. And that she remains there for the rest of her life. And so, you can imagine the pressure of wanting to be the one who's chosen. And so, these women are chosen simply because they're beauty and they're virgins, and they're brought before the king. Now, Esther is one of the women that is chosen. She is a Jewess who lived with her cousin Mordecai. Her parents are dead. Her uncle's daughter has no relatives to bring her and care for, so Mordecai raises her as his own daughter. Now, when she goes before the king, one thing Mordecai tells her, do not, under any circumstance, reveal that you are a Jew. Now, the Bible text does not tell us why Mordecai told her that. But he was very explicit, and she was very faithful to Mordecai. She respected him a great deal, and she did not reveal that she was of Jewish descent, and that was who she belonged to, the people. And so the time came when she was chosen and brought into the harem. She found favor with the keeper of the harem. And he did many things to help her. And then when she came her time to go in before the king, she asked him, what should I take? And he suggested, you take nothing. You take nothing, you just present yourself, and that will be enough. And so she goes in before the king. The king is pleased with her, and he chooses her to be his queen. She is chosen of all the virgins in Shushan, and in the citadel, and in all the province. She is chosen to sit on the throne next to him and to be his queen. Now, Esther has kept her nationality a secret. Nobody knows, not the king, not anybody in the king's court. Nobody knows of her Jewish heritage. And that doesn't really seem to be important now, but it will become very important later on. Now, one day, as circumstances would have it, Mordecai is sitting outside the king's gate, where he sat for a whole year waiting to find out what was happening with Esther. But while he was out there, he overheard a plot that two of the king's servants who were upset with the king, and they determined to assassinate the king. And so he overhears the plot. And so he tells Esther of the plot, and he gives the message to Esther to give to the king's officials that these two men are conspiring to take his wife. And so when the situation was examined, when all the details came out and found out they were exactly as Mordecai had said, then the two officials are taken out and they're hung. But what is very interesting in this account is that there is nothing that's done to show gratitude for what Mordecai did, except one thing. The record of the event is recorded in the King's Chronicles. The event of what happened, what he did, what transpired, what benefit the king received, they were written in the Chronicles of the King by the scribe, and they are part of the record that he has of his kingship. Now, so far, we've been introduced to the king. We've been introduced to Mordecai and Esther. And now we're going to be introduced to the other main player in this city, and it is Haman. Haman is what we might call his chief minister. He is the chief of staff of the king's, of his council, and he made Haman second in command. What he did is promoted. And he became the second in command of all the Persian realm. And all were to bow and pay homage to him just like they did the king. They were to respect the authority and the position that the king had bestowed upon him. And all the men in the province, when they came in his presence, bowed and paid homage to him because of his position. All except one man. Mordecai refused to bow before Haman. And the reason that he would not bow is because he was a Jew. And because his allegiance was to God and not to any man. And so he was not going to bow. And not only Haman, but the real faithful Jew would never bow and pay homage to Mordecai, to Haman. And it appears from the text that this was kind of a reverent thing. Something like paying him homage like he's a god. And Mordecai absolutely refused to do that. And that enraged Haman, that this man would not pay homage to him. And Haman became so angry, he didn't want to just destroy Mordecai. He wanted to destroy every Jew that was in the province of the king's realm. Every Jew that lived in any of the province where he had authority, he wanted them out. He wanted them put to death because this one man would not bow and pay respect to him. How was he going to accomplish that? He came to the king, and Haman told the king that the Jews did not follow his law, that they were really rebellious, and they really didn't respect the king, nor did they respect his law. And so what he did is he offered 10,000 talents of silver to enrich the king's treasury if he would sign a decree that all the Jews in the provinces would be killed on a certain day, the 12th month and the 12th day of Adar, that they would all be put to death. And it pleased the king. And the decree was determined, and it was stamped with the king's signet ring. Now, when a thing was stamped with the signet of the king's ring, that means that it was law. That means it couldn't be altered. That means it couldn't be changed. That means it was written, as we might say, written in stone. And so this letter went out to all of the provinces of the king. And you know how the Jews reacted. When the Jews read what was coming, it caused great grief. They put sackcloth and ashes. They went into deep mourning. Mordecai went to the front of the gate, tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and sent in the gate, and he mourned because of the decree that had been signed. Now, a copy of that edict was given to Queen Esther. And when she found out what was happening, her first attention goes to Mordecai. And Mordecai asked Esther to go to the king and intercede on behalf of her people. He couldn't do anything. The Jews were helpless to do anything. He had signed it with the signet ring. It was a law. It was going to be done. It was months away, but on a selected day, they were going to kill every Jew in the province, and they were going to loot, and they were going to get booty, and they were going to destroy them as a people. And Mordecai said, "You're in a position that you can help us." And so he asked her to use her position to give word to the king. Now, at first, she is fearful, and she is reluctant, because she's fear that she'll be put to death. In Esther chapter 4, and in verse number 11, chapter 4 and verse 11, it says, "And all the king's servants and the people of the king's province know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called into his presence these last 30 days." And so he tells Mordecai Esther's words. Now, notice that she understands the law of Persia. She understands what will happen if she goes into the king unannounced. And death is a sentence that she'll get, even though she's queen. Because everybody's under the same law. And so she's reluctant to go. But listen to the words of Mordecai. "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this." Then Esther told them to return the answer Mordecai thus: "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan. Fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days or nights. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." What is Esther stating? Esther understands the law. Esther understands the grave situation the Jews are in. She understands the position she will place herself in. But she has the courage that she's going to fast, she's going to pray, and ask all the Jews to do the same. And then at the end of 3 days, she's going in to the court of the king. And if she dies, she dies. She is willing to take the risk in order to protect her people. And so Mordecai was given the message. Now, the next 3 days later, when Esther went before the king, she stood outside the inner court. He was in the king, and the way I understand it from reading is that he was in his realm where he would make judgments, and she was in the outer court. They both could see each other. He saw Esther, and he held out the golden scepter. That meant that he called her to his presence. And therefore, that means her life would be spared. She would not be going in unannounced. And so, Esther requests, and the king says, "What do you want, Esther? I'll give it to you up to half my kingdom. Whatever you request, I'll give you. What do you want?" Now, it seems strange what she asked for, but not really, because she has a plan. And so what Esther asked for is, she asked that there would be a banquet. And the only two people present at that banquet would be the king and Haman, his second in command, and to attend a special banquet that she would prepare in their honor. And so when asked, she said she would tell them tomorrow at another special banquet for the king and for Haman. So when they come together in that first banquet, he says, "Okay, now what do you want? What request do you have? What can I do for you?" She says, "Grant me that we come together tomorrow in a special banquet that's for you and for Haman, and at that time I will reveal to you what I desire." The king says, "Okay, that's fine. That's what we'll do." And so Haman was elated. He was elated, but seeing Mordecai at the gate caused him to lose his joy. Here he is in the presence of the king. Him, the queen, and Esther. Esther, there's just the three of them. And now they're going to have another special banquet just for him and the king with Esther. And he's elated. His ego is just running loose. But then he walks to go home and he goes out the gate. And who does he see sitting there? But Mordecai. And Mordecai's not paying homage. He's not bowing to him. And all of his joy dissipates. And intending the next day, he goes home and he tells his wife and friends about what's going to happen. And then he mentions Mordecai. And how can he be joyous and how can he have all this joy in his heart when Mordecai, this Jew, refuses to bow and pay me homage? His wife said, well, you're in a high position. Go to the king and ask that he be hung on the gallows. Build some gallows, go to the king, and ask that Mordecai be hung on the gallows. And he says, that's a good idea, and that's what I'll do. And so he commands that a gallows be made to be built, and it's 75 feet high, and he's going to go to the king the next day, and he's going to ask for the life of Mordecai. And so now he goes to bed happy. Now, all of this seems to be working against Esther. But not really. The king has a sleepless night. He can't sleep. Sleep, for whatever reason, he cannot sleep. And so what he does is he asks that the king's chronicles be brought before him and be read. And the Bible tells us in Esther 6, the night the king could not sleep, so one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the chronicles. And they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers, who had sought to lay hand on the king. Now, what does he want to know? This man saved my life. What did I do for him? And so he asked, what reward did he receive? And the chronicle said he didn't receive any. He said he did this thing to help and save the life of the king, but no reward was given to Mordecai for his action. And so Haman was in the court. He wanted to know, well, who's in the court? He wanted to ask somebody's counsel what he should do for Mordecai. What should I do to demonstrate my thankfulness and gratitude for what he did? He said, well, Haman just came in. Now, why did Haman come in the court that day? He was going to go to the king and ask Mordecai to be hung in the gallows. And so he goes in before the king. And Mordecai is asked, what should be done to the man that I want to pay great honor to? What should I do for him? And Haman, thinking he's talking about Haman, who is in greater honor than me? Who could he be talking about who's in greater honor with the king than me? I'm going to have a banquet with him and his wife. Then who's in a better position than me? And so he says, here's what you should do. You should take one of your robes that you have worn. You should put it on him. You should put it on one of the animals that you have rolled on. You should parade him all through the citadel. And you should cry out to pay homage and respect for the man whom the king honored. Mordecai all the time thinking that he's really describing what's going to happen to him. And the king says, that's wonderful. Get Mordecai and do everything that you've just told me. And don't leave anything out. Now you picture this. Here is a man that this man hates. A man that he wants hung in the gallows. A man he wants killed. And because of his rage against this man, he's willing to kill every Jew in the province. And now he's told to put him on the king's animal, put a robe on him, parade him all through the citadel, and cry out that this man should be honored because the king is honored. Now, how low do you think Mordecai was? How low do you think Haman was? Here Haman is, the tables have been turned. And now the one that he wants dead, now how is he going to go to the king and say, by the way, I want you to hang this man on a gallows? He's not about to do that, is he? So now he's in a dilemma. And so now he is greatly saddened. Now, the problem is, he goes home and he tells his wife of the events, and he's saddened, and she's afraid, and he's afraid, because if Mordecai is against you and he has won favor of the king, you are in a precarious position. And before he could think what that meant, It was time to go to the banquet. And then the banquet. Here's Haman, the king, and Esther. And in Esther 7 and verse 4, Esther reveals what she desires. "For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed and to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." We are doomed to die, my people and me. So what's the king want to know? What does he want to know? So the king's angry, and he answers his Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is he? Who would do or presume to do this? To do this in his heart, to do such a thing?" And Esther said, "The adversary, the enemy, is the wicked Haman." Haman is terrified before the king and queen. And he is so enraged, he goes out. But Haman knows that now he's in trouble. And he's in real trouble. And what does he do? He pleads and begs for his life. And when he does, he falls on Esther, who is lounging on a lounge. And that's when his husband comes in. He says, "Look at what this man's done. He's not only tried to kill my wife and her, all of her people, now he's even tried to attack the queen." And he has his head covered. And here's what he does. "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hang Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's wrath was subsided. It all turned around, didn't it? Now I want you to notice something. You haven't read one word about God in all of this story. You know, this is the only book in the Bible that God's name is not mentioned. But do you see God in this book? You see God through every page of this story. And what is called is God's providence. It is God taking the normal activities of men and working them out to his advantage to do his will. Now, what do we know from history? That all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed through the Jewish line of heritage. If all the Jews are wiped out in Sushan, if all the Jews are wiped out and they're exterminated, then how is he going to keep that promise? That line must remain intact. How's that going to happen? God takes care of it through a woman named Esther. And she saves her people. But now Haman's dead, but what about the decree? You still got the decree. Haman's dead, he can't kill Mordecai, but what about the decree? So Mordecai is promoted. So the king took off the signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, gave it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now who's second in command? Now Mordecai is second in command. And the first thing that has to be done as him second in command is take care of that edict. We got to do something because the days are coming swiftly where that edict is to be carried out. And so the king makes a new edict. He makes a new decree. And he sends letters again. And it says in chapter 8 and verse 11, "By these letters the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together to protect their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the forces of any people or any province who would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions." In other words, they could protect themselves and they would be able to fight back and they would not lose their life, their land, and their occupation. And that's exactly what they did. And Haman's plot is destroyed and God's people are saved. Because of the events that there's a feast that the Jews began to keep, it was called the Feast of Purim. And Mordecai set a decree setting aside an annual holiday for this day for the Jews. It was to remind them of the deliverance that came from God by the actions of Esther and by God through His providence that protected them from being destroyed. These are called the days of Purim. And some of the Jews still keep this feast to this day. They celebrate it in the last days of February. And every year it's an annual thing that reminds them of the time that they were saved in Persia. And it commemorates how Esther saved her people from total destruction. Now it's a wonderful story. It's a story of love, of courage, of determination, of trust, but it is the greatest story of God's providence, of God's providential care. Now, in closing tonight, what can we learn from the book of Esther? In Esther chapter 1, verse 10 and 11, in the beginning of this book, it says to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show off her beauty to the people and to the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come to the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious and angry burnt within him. We don't know a lot about Queen Vashti, but we do know something about her, that she's a modest woman. Do you notice in the text it says to wear her crown? Didn't say anything about her robe. Didn't say anything about her garment. That said just wear her crown and come before the men at this feast. She refused to do so. And so she refused to parade before drunken and lustful men because of her dignity and because of her integrity. And it's a challenge to learn the beauty of holiness. It's a challenge to learn that you don't have to go along with the crowd. You don't have to go in to do something wrong. You can't be forced to do what's wrong. You can only go along with it. Somebody can request you to do something that you know to be wrong. You can feel pressure. There can be danger in you doing the right thing. But nobody can make you do it. You must stand for what you know to be right. And brethren, we live with this kind of pressure every day. Our young people live with this kind of pressure every day to conform to society and to their peers. To fit in. To do things that they do. To talk like they talk. To live like they do. To make decisions like they do. And do not be deceived that that pressure isn't real. It's as real for them as it is for us. And they don't have the experience or sometimes the maturity to understand the bigger picture if they give in to the pressure. You must have integrity. And you must do what's right, no matter what the circumstances are around you. It would have been easier for Esther. She could have retained her crown. She could have remained queen if she had just gave in and did what the king requested. She didn't take the easy route. And neither should we. You know what that is? That's the lesson of Romans 12 in action. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. What that means is you've got to do things the way that God would want you to do them, not the way that the world wants you to go. Vashti kept her integrity. She held to her principles, and she did not give up. We don't know enough. We don't know a lot about the woman, but we know a lot that we can commend about her attitude and her conduct. Another lesson from Esther is in chapter 4, verse 16. Her willingness to go to the king, even though she knew that his life would be in danger if she was not called by the king. And so we need to always be ready to serve. We need to have unwavering dedication to God. And we must be willing to risk even our own life if it's in the realm of doing what God would have us to do. Now when you read, here's something that I think that we have a great deal of difficulty in comprehending. We don't live in a time where we are persecuted the way that the first century Christians were persecuted. These men and women would lose their home, their occupation, their lands, their livelihood. Sometimes their family members would be put to death right before their eyes. And all they had to do to escape any of that is just confess Caesar as God. Now we haven't been put to that test yet. But what if we were? What if we're put to the test that we have to demonstrate unwavering loyalty to God, even when it's not in our physical best interest to do so. You know, people find it hard to serve God two times a week on Sunday. What would they do if they were faced with the proposition that if you won't deny Christ, we're going to take the life, we're going to take the life of your spouse or of your children? Now, we look at those men and women in days of old, and we think they were something special. No, they weren't special. They had deep, abiding faith and trust in God. And brethren, the days are hastening quickly that we're going to have the same type of faith and trust and dedication, because the world is going in the wrong direction. And you and I are in a minority. We are in a minority. We are looked at as the problem. We are looked at as an obstacle to what men and women think and want to do today. And our understanding and our commitment and our dedication is demonstrated and is called fanaticalism. We're called a heretic. We're called a zealot. We're a religious Bible thumper. No, we're not going to be cast in prison. Our lands aren't going to be taken from us. Our loved ones aren't going to be put to death. But, ladies and gentlemen, God still says that all that live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Our persecution comes in another way, to make us ashamed of who we are, what we believe, and what we stand for. And all that the opposition wants is for you to remain silent, say nothing, do nothing, and just fold into the woodwork. Just mesh into the crowd. Don't make waves. Don't rock the boat. That won't work. And here's why it won't work. Because that's not going to satisfy us. Even if we remain silent, we don't talk, we don't make waves, we don't rock the boat, we don't hold to our integrity, we don't hold the godly principle, that is not going to suffice. And if you do not believe it, look at how things keep getting farther and farther away from God. They are never satisfied. They will never be satisfied until we become exactly like they are. Do you have the courage to stand against that? You know, we've taught our children that all our life, that you've got to believe in who you are and what you are and not allow others to lead you down the road. You know what? We better listen to what we try to teach our children, because we may have to start putting it to practice in our own life. Well, Mordecai wasn't worried. If Esther would not do what needed to be done, he wasn't worried. Why? Because if you don't answer this call, relief will come from another source. You see, he knew God's will. He knew what God's law was, and he knew that God would protect him. And even if Esther didn't do this, he knew God would intervene, or in some way, God would make it come out right. You see, he didn't worry. You see, he understood God's sovereignty. And you know, that's something that we need to know, have today. No matter what decision people in authority make, they're not going to overrule God. God is the one that's in control. God rules the nations of men. God is going to have final say, and everything is going to go the way that God has designed for it to go, no matter what man decides to do. And if men begin to go in a way that's contrary to what God wants, God has the ability to put it to an end. To say, that's enough. You've had your time, now your time is up. The second thing we need to know, that God's will always be done. No matter what men do, they have free will. They can choose to do whatever they want. But whatever decision they make, God's will in the final analysis is going to be accomplished. And you and I should never, ever doubt that. Esther and Mordecai's faith helped deliver God's people from being destroyed. You see, God protected them, but he did so by using the integrity and the faith of a man named Mordecai and a woman named Esther. He used faithful servants, standing in the gap, standing in the place. Remember what Mordecai told Esther. Who knows that you have come to such a time as this, to be put in this position at this time, at this place, in order to accomplish what God needs to have done. And you know what? We never know if we have arrived in a place that God has put us in time and through His providence to react to a given situation that may have favorable results for many years to come. We don't know that. But we do know, if we trust God, if we have integrity, if we believe that God is in control, we're going to react properly. And we're going to act with faith, we're going to act with conviction, and we're going to act with determination that God will see us through no matter what the end might be for us personally. Esther is a powerful, powerful story of how God's providence works in life. We live in a society that we have free will and free choice. We make the decisions. We make the choices. 2 Corinthians 5 verse 10 says we'll be judged by the choices we make. And last, God will make all those choices come out right in our own life if we trust Him, if we have faith in Him, and if we will obey Him rather than men. And I leave you with a New Testament parallel. Peter and the apostles were brought before the Sanhedrin Council the second time in Acts 5. They were commanded in Acts 4, don't you preach anymore in this man's name? Don't you do anything to try to bring his blood upon us? You no longer preach or teach in his name. And they threatened them, and they sent them away. And they went on and they glorified God, and the Bible says in Acts 4 that they went and they rehearsed what happened, and then they prayed to God. And what did they pray for? They prayed for boldness and plainness of speech, that they would do and say what was right and what God wanted. And in Acts chapter 5, they went out again and they began to preach and teach in the name of Christ, in the synagogues, in the homes. They went from place to place and they brought in before the council again. And they said, did we not warn you? Did we not tell you straightway not to teach in this man's name anymore? And you are just content and you are willing to try to bring this man's blood upon us, and we told you not to do it. Remember what they said in Acts 5 verse 29? We ought to obey God rather than men. And they were taken and they were beaten and then they were thrown out, and when they left, they went to the other disciples, they prayed together, and they thanked God that they were worthy to suffer for His name's sake. Do we have that kind of trusting and abiding faith in God and in His ways in the world that we live in? If we don't, we had better get it, because that's what God demands of us who are His children. If you're here tonight and you're not a child of God, the world is a difficult place. And the devil is ever about trying to destroy you, destroy any attempt and any effort you'll make to serve God. And he's going to do everything that you open the door and let him do in your life. He's going to set traps in front of you. He's going to set snares. He's going to try to convince you to wait. He's going to try to convince you that you've got all the time in the world, and all he wants you to do is just do nothing. If you do nothing, that satisfies the devil, because when you're doing nothing, you're right where he wants you to be. Running obedience to the gospel is a personal decision. It cannot be made by any other person. It must be made by the individual who is outside the realm of safety. One who is in sin. One who is separated from God. Not because they're an evil person. Not because they're not a good person. Not because there's not any good in them. The thing that separates them is because they sin. Sin separates you from God. And there's nothing you can do about that sin yourself without the help of God. God provided the remedy. We talked about it last Sunday. The remedy is the blood of Christ. By hearing the word of God, repenting of your sin, confessing his name and submitting to baptism, you can contact the blood that will wash away your sin. That's what Paul did in Acts 22, verse 16, when he recounts his conversion from Ananias. Arise and be baptized and wash away thy sin, calling on the name of the Lord. And then we must do what Paul did. Remember when he was sitting in that jail in 2 Timothy 4, and he was about to be beheaded for his faith in Christ. It was his second imprisonment. He said, I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. He wasn't worried. He did what he could do. He did all that he had the ability to do, and he had been faithful in what God called upon him to do. And he was not afraid. What about you and me tonight? Many of us are already children of God. If our life would come to an end, if the Lord would return this very night, are you confident where you'll spend eternity? Are you confident when you stand before that judgment seat, and we all will, and we'll give an account of our life, are you confident the words that you will hear from your Savior? If you're faithful, if you have trusting faith, if you have depended upon His grace and His mercy, and you have done your best to live faithfully, you know what words you will hear. Well done, good and faithful servant. But if you played at your life, if you tried to hold on to both worlds, if you tried to ride the fence, you will hear the saddest words and the last words you will ever hear. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity, I never knew you. God leaves you the choice in what words you hear. If we can help you tonight prepare for that day, we ask you to come forward as together we stand and sing.